horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back 10 minutes into hour two on this Thursday, and absolutely couldn't resist reaching out to Ryan Flanders, who you know better as Benny South Street, B South Street on your Twitter machine and Trip Notes Pros. Could not resist the opportunity to talk to him because they opened up qualification for the 2022 NHC about 10 minutes ago. And Ryan is double qualified. Unbelievable. Ryan, well done.
Power of prayer. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the kind words.
It's pretty funny. I mean, there were people who were still trying to qualify last weekend for 2021, and here you are with back-to-back hits. And it does happen this way, although you said you can't remember, winning contests like this back-to-back.
You know, it's funny, as you mentioned the week prior that people were trying to qualify for this year's NHC. That was me. I was trying to qualify for this year's, and I didn't get in. I just wasn't committed the way I probably should have been. I think you have to be to qualify for that one. It's tough. There's so many good players out there. But, I decided at the beginning of this year I'd stick my throw my hat in the ring and see what happened and stick in there for the year, and lo and behold, I got lucky. Good to be lucky.
Too funny. Walk us through the contests.
Well, the first one was one of the $165 varieties. I decided at the beginning of the year I was going to chase the tour because I was watching all these replays anyway, and I might as well just play every week. So I did that contest. It was a live contest. I felt the card was pretty chalky for the most part. It was a lot of it was the stakes card at Sam Houston, and I got a couple decent prices, which put me in a position to just play who I liked the rest of the way. And as it played out, it was chalky, and the scores were pretty low. So I was fortunate in that regard. And then the bigger one, there was like 400 people in there, and it was a pick and pray contest, and had a few big numbers that carried me. I think the total wasn't crazy, but it was something like $110 and. Things are hard to win. I was looking at these lists of players, and I've had so many conversations with many of these guys. They're excellent players, so I think you've got to stay committed if you want to qualify for that contest. Even if you don't make it, just stick in there, get in on the cheap, do the feeders early in the week,
right?
And if you stay committed throughout the year, I think your odds of qualifying are pretty good. And even if you don't. They take the top, I want to say it's 75 players that haven't earned a seat that are the top point winners that haven't earned a seat. So those people get in as well. So that would be my advice, would be just stay committed and earn your way in cheaply.
There's no doubt. And that, that's a formula that, there's any number of people over the years that we've talked to. And, it's very notable. If we went back to the end of January, or might have been the first week in February, when I had Keith Shamblin in to kind of wrap things up a little bit, even though we're not going to crown an NHC champ until August, but you go through that list of the top 75 non-qualified. There's some prominent names that made it that way this past year. People that, ordinarily you see them, getting in, just as a matter of course over a year. I mean, and obviously some people take, there's certain distractions. Nick Tamro, Nick did not, focus much this year. He's had a new baby. I mean, you know, there's things that get in the way of being able to focus in on you know, that kind of a run. And of course, you talk about how, you know, launching Trip Notes Pros has been, you know, something that is obviously taking a lot of your focus.
Yeah. So as far as the business goes, I just Tyler Hoffman and I, we started a company. Actually, Paul Cush was our original Trip Note author and myself, and we brought in Tyler Hoffman. So there are three of us, and I think between the three of us, I think we have four NHC seats for next year, which is pretty cool.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, you can see, and we've got Alexa Zepp now, she's an unbelievable player, super talented, and she's the one that created, I don't know if you knew this, but she's the one that created the artwork for the BCBC
previous
year.
Yes, so, yes, yes,
super,
absolutely.
Super cool.
That's right.
So she's on our team as well, and the contest world has been very kind to us, and it's funny because if you analyze our picks on horse tourneys and at horse players, most of the time they're in direct correlation with what we're seeing and what what we're writing on the website at Trip Note Pros. So we just, you know, you got to put in the time. I think if you go through the motions, then you're just buying lottery tickets, and the odds of you converting that into success, you know, I think the odds are pretty long, because there are so many good players that do spend the time. But we're just trying to do the work, and I think if you're willing to not get outworked, which that's kind of our motto, you're going to be successful. So far, so good. We've had a nice beginning to the year for everybody.
Talk also as part of, you know, the conversation that we had, I think, going back to, late summer when you were, you know, really fully launching. How have things changed? How is it streamlined? What, for those that, that have either, you know, seen some of the free offerings and haven't subscribed, talk a little bit about, you know, where you are right now and you know, what, the packages, what the tracks are that you're offering and how it, you know, how people can approach it.
Yeah, so we've got a few things going on right now. It was hard, I'm not going to lie. There have been some bumps along the road. Startups are not easy, and we've spent a lot of time. I'm still working between 12 and 16 hours a day, depending on the day, just trying to manage the business and then obviously get the Trip Notes done. So we're currently moving the site into a much more user-friendly place. It's been a little bit fragile, what we created in the beginning, but super, super excited because this is just going to start to come to fruition now. Some of the things that we've got going on, first and foremost, the NTRA, we're going to be doing a free card for the March 6th contest. So we'll be doing the Trip Notes for those respective races within that contest at horseplayers.com. So that'll be coming up soon. Excited about that. You will need to actually sign up for a free account to be able to access the notes. But once you're in there, everything will be free and you'll be able to take a look at what we have. And we're currently at santanita.com. If you go to the handicappers section, there's a Trip Note Pros section where you can click on the golden hour notes. So we do those every day. We've got a real nice thing going with Santa Anita, so that's been great. And a couple of the new things that are going on that haven't been implemented yet, but will in the coming weeks, months, we're going to get a chat room going of sorts where members can, you know, just dialogue with one another about horse racing in general, but mostly we'd like to focus in on the trips because that's what our focus is. So people can dialogue about trips. What was this jockey trying to do? Was this a good move? Is this a bad ride? Et cetera, et cetera. So excited about that. Would love to get some interesting content going for the members that way. And then I'll be hosting some webinars as well, some webinars to kind of answer questions, do Q&As, and go through some trip analysis, because I get a lot of questions, surprisingly, from really good players that they reach out and they want to know what I thought of a certain trip or what Tyler thought of a certain trip, what we're looking for, how we go about writing the trips, et cetera. So the webinars will be key in that respect to kind of get people engaged. And then another thing we've done and we have executed, which has been nice, is Spanish. So we're currently doing just a couple different tracks, Santa Anita and Gulfstream. I'd like to bring on Naira for one day of the week, probably a Saturday in the coming weeks. So we'll be doing hopefully three. Right now it's just Gulfstream and Anita, but I'd like to do at least one day a week for the Naira track. And Spanish has been implemented. So if you go to Gulfstream and you buy their notes, it's a bilingual site.
Nice.
So just trying to break into that arena as well. We feel like there's an opportunity there to help some of the Spanish-speaking fans that maybe don't have access to some of the really good information that's out there for other players.
Well, I'm putting up the link. I'm trying to keep track of all of this, and I'm putting up the link for people that for those that haven't visited the Santa Anita handicapping page, there's a litany of information and free materials that isolate in on various races, and whether it's Jeff Siegel's analysis, I see that Optics EQ will do an offering, and so everybody's got their own access, and so you can basically lock in a bookmark. So I'm going to send that out, and I'm glad you mentioned we're still 2 weeks away, but that March 6th will be the first free NTRA sponsored contest, free qualification for 2022, and we'll keep reminding everybody as we inch closer to the first opportunity, because really, Ryan, you bring up a terrific element to qualifying for NHC. It doesn't have to be a big budget approach. There's I think of our friend Jim Sebas, he takes every free chance. He plays the best ratio opportunities, the low cost buy-ins to qualify in to the weekend events, and has run up I think 8 or 9 or 10 qualifications over the years. So it doesn't, there's obviously plenty of people that can play the full price route, and don't necessarily have time during the week to play in, or just are willing to do it that way, which is fine. It's great. But if you want to take advantage of every piece of material that is out there, good for you, and good for for you and the team to be supporting all the different endeavors with the trip notes, and then the rest of the time people are invited and should be subscribing. I mean, almost every day when they're out there, Ryan, I see people saying thank you, and that they landed on a horse that that basically the trip notes offered that they wouldn't have found otherwise.
Yeah, there are a few things that happen, but getting the love back from people and getting the emails that say thank you, I never would have included this horse in my try, or I had this winner. It makes the work worth it, because it is a labor of love, and it does take a lot of time and effort, and it's real sweat. So we're putting in the time, and it's great to get that love back from people. We had something happen recently where Christina Blacker on TVG brought up a trip note that we had, and I I was almost in tears. I was so happy, thinking, man. We made it onto TVG unsolicited, so that was super, super cool, knowing that someone that was out there that I respect, that a company like that is comfortable with her going out and stepping out and talking about our product. That was super, super cool. So, yeah, it's been a good start to the year. We just got to keep this momentum going, and hopefully this time next year we'll have some real nice success stories.
Well, you're already writing the success story yourself, and I suppose, you know, with these early scores and the double qualification, now you're as Jonathan famously said, the tour chooses you. I guess the 2022 tour, you're going to have to keep at it.
I am. You know, it's funny. I got a text message last night from my good buddy Brent Sumja, who kind of said those same words, and he said, I hope you're chasing the tour, because you'll be happy if you do, and it's worth it if you win. You'll never forget it. And I said, actually, yeah, I am. So that was nice. You know, the big thing, too, for me is at the beginning of the year, before this last tour had ended, I was very, very lucky. It was not a skillful contest, but I was very, very lucky. I finished second in a FloCal tournament and cashed for a little over $80,000. So that funded my tour. So I don't have to worry about being overly cautious with the feeders. I'm going to play every week this year. So that was a big lucky one as well.
Well, with the rolling start, and you know, since you're as mentioned, you know, since you're combing the replays for, you know, for opportunities, you feel, you know, it feels like you'll be a presence and a force, you know, throughout the campaign. Take a minute to Ryan. We should really. You know, I had this conversation partly with Andy on Tuesday, and I think I asked you the same question last year when we talked about, you know, the whole trip concept and the, you know, the ability to watch a replay, and in some cases, while having to watch a replay several times. I mean, that's why this is real work. Talk about what to look for, and, you know, for people that, you know, probably see a race and they don't really know what trouble is or what a authentic trip is, that people aren't going to see so readily. I mean, everybody, you know, sees run backs or you'll see commentary out there about, you know, so, you know, whoever the horse is in question that had to check hard, and that kind of trouble is obvious to everybody. But finding subtle trouble and hidden, you know, hidden gems. How do people teach themselves? You know, I don't want them to not subscribe. But for those that are you know, hoping to learn how to watch a race better, what advice do you have?
Well, I'll give you a few different nuggets here that I think people can take away and kind of try and sharpen their game a little bit when it comes to watching trips. The first would be stare at one horse. So as an avid horse racing fan, when you watch a race, typically you're not doing that. Right? So you're watching kind of that flyover level where you're kind of trying to understand the pace. You're mostly focusing on a horse that you've played or a horse that you're interested in, maybe some of the other logicals, and your eyes are skipping around, right? So the minute you watch that race where you're not focused on one horse, you're missing everything. That would be my first advice. Hindsight is 20/20, so we have the ability now to watch replays and to do it the right way. You stare at that one horse because there's so much information that goes into that. You can see that horse's body language. You can watch the head-ons. You can tell if a horse is comfortable, if he's not. Hated being down on the inside. You can see him kind of cock his head, and he's telling you, I don't like it down here. As a matter of fact, Tyler Hoffman wrote a note about a horse at the Golden Hour this just past week, and he wrote, this horse hated the inside. Upgrade the performance. He's drawn outside today. This wasn't a slam dunk by any means, but we knew that the horse, Tyler knew that the horse hated the inside. Sure enough, the horse, he came back, he won, and he paid like $67. So you, these kinds of things, that would be my first advice. Stare at one horse. My second piece of advice would be understand the surface that you're watching. So turf races are about pace and flow more so than they are about speed. So ground loss is super important. Positioning is super important. Jockeys' decision-making skills are more so in play. So, you know, in dirt racing, you're always looking to be the controlling speed almost every time. So horses tend to duel more in dirt racing. In turf racing, not so much because they don't have that throwback to deal with. So you have to understand that I think the surfaces are really important, and pace flow analysis and race flow. So that would be another thing. And then the biggest thing for us is the jockey intent. So, and you get this a lot in baby races, and I've explained this to a lot of our members. When you're watching I'll give you an example. You have a first-time starter, and a jockey climbs on, and you're not in the know, right? So you don't know what the barn thinks of their horse, if today's a prep, if this horse wants longer, etc. So when you're watching that replay, again, hindsight is 20/20. So you have to figure out, or at least try to figure out, what were they trying to achieve in this race? And you can tell a lot by a jockey when he leaves that gate in the first five jumps. For example, you get a rider that's in an all-out send. You know, maybe he gets a couple backhanders even. So, to me, that's a live horse. They want the top, right? So they're trying to make the lead. They've been given instructions as much, probably. You know, let's get him in front. He's got speed. Let's see if you can make the top. So that almost leads into trainer intent. Whereas if you get a first time starter that the jockey is not so enthusiastic early, that was probably a plan as well. You know, he's probably got a late kick, and if he doesn't kick, maybe this wasn't the day anyway. So I try and study what it is that those riders are doing when those horses first make it to the track, because that first line in the PPs is important because it begins to tell you everything about that horse. And then it's a lot easier to keep up with that specific horse. So you have to develop an opinion. You're not always going to be right. But if you can be right some of the time, that's when you start to get in and you find some value. Like, hey, you know, this one, we believed that this one was meant for longer. This rider didn't try literally until the top of the stretch when the race was already decided. This absolutely looked like a prep race. And then you can kind of, as those PPs move along, you get a better understanding of what the goals were for that horse. And as a horse player, that's really valuable stuff, which we believe is the real value in horse playing, because a lot of these things don't show up on the tote. They're not baked into the price like all the other software analysis that's out there that's hard to compete with. So that's kind of where we're at. So those would be the few things that nice. I would try and focus at. They're pretty simple, but they do take time. You've got to put in the work.
That's the key watchword is the work. And you know, it's funny. Yesterday, I in that conversation with Dave Hill about his piece in The Ringer about the GameStop success of Michael McCaskill from Louisville, and it to me there was just an obvious parallel to, you know, the horse playing side, and you know, having layers and layers of comprehension and trial and error and, you know, experience. You put yourself in a position to be successful by, you know, being open to, you know, new areas and adding to your expertise, and then, you know, putting in the effort, and that pays off. I mean, it may take, you know, might not happen immediately. It might, you know, you might miss bet, you know, which is a different kind of frustration, but you'll know when you've reached a critical mass of understanding, and you'll also know and have the greatest satisfaction there is in gambling when you find something that the public didn't see, that the chart caller didn't see, that, you know, nobody that wrote the race up or talked about the race on air, and you know that a horse is coming into a spot that's favorable, and that's what this is about. And you know, you're not only you're doing it to help others, you're doing it for yourself as well. So Ryan, brilliant work, and let me know whatever we can continue to provide people with updates on Trip Notes Pros and the places that it'll be free, or places that people can buy it and use the product and improve their own play. So I appreciate it. Always have fun talking to you.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the kind words. Big fan. Thank you for all you do, and thanks for having me on.
Benny South Street, everybody. B South Street on Trip Notes Pros, and doing it himself, and he's going to be up there on the leaderboard. And of course, Dylan Donnelly last year, start to finish, and to finish second, and I'm sure he's coming back at it too, and all the other familiar names, the Shermans, and all your fan favorites out there. Follow Ryan on Twitter, B South Street, and also Trip Notes Pros. And he also talked about Tyler. Tyler's been scoring left and right as well, winning contests. I owe him a visit as well. He ran 1-2 the other day over the weekend, I saw. Let's stay right here. Tony Black is standing by, and we haven't been able to talk to Tony for a couple of weeks, so it's good to catch up with the one and only Anthony Black. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and good luck to Benny South Street. I was listening to him. It sounds like he really knows what he's looking at when he's watching horses' performance and jockeys' performance. Key factors in evaluating what a horse can do on any given day. So good luck, Benny South Street.
I love it.
I miss you, Steve. I did miss you.
Well, we missed you, and I'm mentally combing the annals here, Tony. I should look at I should really look at when we had you last. Did we get a chance? I can't remember if we had a chance to talk about John Forbes with you.
No, and I was surprised to hear a few weeks ago. It's been since he passed away, right? And I had the opportunity to ride for him, and I rode a horse for him, Boyce, at Mama's.
Yes, Boyce, yes, that's right.
I think I won three, four in a row on the horse, and a couple of them, I think, the Eatontown and the
Stakes.
And the
that's
Ocean
right.
For it.
That's
and that
right.
was for John. And I didn't ride a lot for John. You know, Julie Crone did a lot of his riding.
Yes.
And he had a lot of respect for Julie. And I always thought, well, maybe that's why I don't do a lot of riding for him. It's Julie and I were like oil and water sometimes. We just didn't mix. But not disrespecting her in any way. You know, there's some riders you really click with and others that you don't. We didn't click. And I'll never forget one day she claimed foul on me. I think it was a Bowie. Bowie or Laura. We were in Merlin, and she was riding in Merlin. And I think I told this story before, and she was telling the stewards how blind I am, and he can't see, and I was on the inside, and he didn't even know I was there. And, of course, you know, I said the reason I knew she was there, and I made it tight, of course, was because I can see. If I couldn't see, I would have probably dropped her, and she wouldn't have walked. She'd have been walking back. But I do see, and I do ride riders tight, and I don't like them getting through, but I don't cross the line of what's dangerous. And, of course, the number stayed up, and Julie, from that moment on, wasn't real fond of my riding style, but you did figure out you're better off coming around than you are trying to get through. But that was Julie. But John really respected her riding, and who didn't? I mean, she's a world-class rider. But I was fortunate enough to go to Monmouth 1 year, and I don't know how I wound up on this horse, and I think he had claimed the horse, and he ran it for the claiming price, $20,000, $25,000 or whatever, the first time I rode the horse, and it won, and then I wound up winning, I think, a three other than on him, and two stakes after that, I think. You know, this is a wild.
Yeah, and I remember that. Absolutely. Yeah.
I was real lucky to get on the horse and stay on him, and it kind of really sparked my meet at Monmouth, because I was staying up there that year. And I don't even remember what year it was. Was it in the 90s?
It's got to be the mid-90s. Yeah, it's got to be.
96 or 95. I think Jack Service had my book at the time. Jack Service. He was a well-known agent in Jersey and Pennsylvania, related to John and Service and Joe Service, the whole Service family. But Jack was a good agent. He got me in on that horse for Forbes. And wound up you win a couple stakes, and you're a new rider in that particular venue, you know, Monmouth Park. And it kind of puts your name in the hat where you ride for a lot of different people. And we had a respectable meet up there at that particular time, and that was thanks to John. And John was a great horseman. I think John, if I remember correctly, came around the old man John Tamaro.
Yes.
I think he worked for John Tamaro for quite a while. And what a great teacher old man John Tamaro was. In fact, both his sons, Mike and John Jr., are tremendous trainers. But John Forbes had all the credentials, a top-notch trainer, took great care of his horses, ran a moderately large outfit, and was well-known in the Jersey Circuit. And wherever he shipped, you knew one thing about it. His horses were well-prepared and ran good. And he's one of the kind of the horsemen that the business is sorry to lose.
Yeah.
You know, John was a good horseman. A lot of old school ideas that work today. You know, he wasn't caught in a time warp. His old school was good, solid thinking when it comes to horses and horse racing. But they were ideas that were brought up to date and worked today. He'll be sorely missed.
I appreciate. I didn't think we had it had a chance, Tony. I thought the 2 weeks that we missed you coincided, and I'm just looking at Boyce now, and you had a really nice run. You won the Longfellow, and the Oceanport.
That's what it was. Okay.
Won both of those that summer, and you won five races in a string of seven starts. And boy, he really did go up the ladder. The season ended at Garden State with a win, and then he let you ride him in a 50 claimer. Then he cleared. Then he was second in an allowance. Then he wins the Oceanport. Then he won the Battlefield. Then the Longfellow, and then he kind of misfired in the Belmont Breeders' Cup Handicap. In September, you went to New York with him, and Dove Hunt, you finished a bad sixth in there that day.
Yeah, I kind of remember that, and it just shows you horses get good, and at times they carry it on for a while, and then they come to a point where they tail off, as any athlete. You know, they misfire, or racing conditions didn't suit him that day. But he was one of those turf horses you could almost count on every time you rode him, and he really gave me a lot of thrills that particular year and those particular seven times that I rode him. So, and I'm sure I thanked John several times for putting me on him. And who was the owner? Was
it Mrs. Marsh, the Hazel Marsh from Virginia?
The blue colors. I thought it was. I was thinking about the colors, and I said, "Yeah, Mrs. Marsh." You know, that's who it was. So, if these old, these horses, you know, you wind up making contact with a trainer because of an agent or because the horse, you just wind up on them because they don't get the preferred rider on them that particular day. And you never know, jockeys fall into lucky spots, and I fell into a lucky spot that day. I'll tell you another lucky spot I fell into. I heard at the beginning of the show you talking about the John B. Campbell.
Yeah.
And I won the John B. Campbell on a horse called Majesty's World. I rode that horse for two different trainers. One time I rode him at Meadowlands, and they had a double card that day, one of the few double cards they ran, an afternoon card and a night card. And I rode two winners in the afternoon card and rode 16 that day. I think I rode 16. Might have even been... the day, was that the day I got married? I'm not sure. Whatever.
Is that the day I got? He remembers the 16 mounts, but he's not so sure about the marriage.
Just shows how the marriage just didn't quite work out. The couple that I was involved in, but the horse racing did work out. But I rode 16 that day. I won two that afternoon and two that night. And of course, you went there.
Oh my God!
And you stayed there all day and all night. And Majesty's World was trained by Frank Alexander, that particular, I think it was on the night card. Yeah, the night card. And I rode Majesty's World, and that was like my third or fourth winner of that double card. And I thought, what a nice horse. Now, I guess that was like, was that like 80, 81?
82. It was 1982. Actually, John Tamaro was training Majesty's World at the time.
Well, Frank Alexander, some way, was in the picture when I rode him at the Meadowlands. I cannot remember. Maybe it was John Tamaro that was trained. I was thinking I rode him for Frank Alexander, and then they shipped the horse to Merlin, and he wound up staying in Merlin and winning the John B. Campbell. And what was that, 83 or 82?
Well, Campbell. I'm looking at the – this is the Campbell. This was the Campbell. And hold on. Yeah, let me pull up. I'll pull up his full. See, it's hard though.
In 81, I think Frank Alexander was training him at Meadowlands.
Interesting. Hold on. Let me.
In 82, John Tamaro got him in Merlin.
Oh, all right. So it was. I gotcha. So it was 82. This is a horse, Majesty's World.
He paid $70. Now, I'll tell you an interesting.
Look at you.
Story. He paid $70. I come down the stretch. I won the race. It was a two or three horse photo. I'm pretty sure I won the race, but as I'm jogging and galloping back, and I was pretty sure I won the race, and you know what? I think the jock that I beat was one that you never beat on the money, was Bill Passmore. He was an unbelievable foxy rider, man. He was unbelievable. And you never beat him on the money. And he was on a horse, I think, Roger Gogo, 38 paces. Was that who finished second? 38 paces.
Hold on. I'm
38.
This is a horse that ran 85 times, folks. Majesty's World. And you know what? This is crazy. This is pretty funny. This is John Marsh. Is this Hazel Marsh's?
I think so. I think there was a connection there. Yeah.
How about
that's
that?
That's right. I got lucky for the Marshes.
Unbelievable. Because this is also, it just so happens that this is also, yeah, this is a Virginia bred as well, and by Mr. Marsh.
Yeah, and what, the horse that finished second in the Campbell, who was it? 38 paces? Was that the name
Hold
of the horse?
Hold on, I'm Tony, let me tell you something.
Leatherberry, I think, trained the horse.
This is some crazy record this horse had. 85
yeah.
starts, 15 wins, 14 seconds. Made $425,000 the hard way. And one of his last, boy, look at this list of riders between you and Vince Percali Jr. and Don Brumfield rode him. And how about Don Macbeth? Macbeth rode him to his last win. You actually rode him to his last stake win.
Stake win? I did, Don. But I remember we were galloping back and Leatherberry's horse was second. And do you have the chart? I mean, the horse that finished second in there?
I will in a second. Because
who I beat, and it was Passmore, I believe. It was 38 paces, maybe.
See, you don't get the charts. The problem is, I've got to go to my racing manuals. But
anyway, Leatherberry's walking into the winner's circle, and I'm galloping back, and I'm thinking, because it was a close photo. And I think, I got there. And they haven't hung the number up yet. And I said, I'm going back to the winner's circle, too. So I'm circling in front of the winner's circle. And then they hang the number up, and Leather walks out of the winner's circle. I see Leather walking out of the winner's circle, and I think, I look back over my shoulder. I did win the race. And you know what? The Campbell at Bowie was the kind of race that every jock wanted to win. It would be like winning the Preakness at Pimlico. If you rode in Merlin, it was probably the premier race. Of course, you wanted to win the Preakness. But the secondary race that you'd like to win in Merlin is the Campbell, and I was fortunate enough to win the Campbell. And it was because I went to Merlin. I believe it was the year they went on strike at Keystone. And I said, I'm not going to sit here dormant. I went to Merlin. And I wound up staying, even when they went back to racing at Keystone. And I stayed at Bowie and even went to a few weeks at Pimlico, because I used to go Laurel, Bowie, Pimlico, and then back to Laurel for the closing of racing in Merlin. And I went to Pimlico. And I'm not sure. I think, and Jimbo and I, we were always close, you know, Bracali. And he was a Merlin rider. I mean, he had stayed home in Merlin, farm in Merlin and everything. But I was lucky enough, I think, that meet to be leading rider at Bowie. I'm pretty sure I wound up leading rider at Bowie. And went down there with nothing except an agent. That was, I think, Jack Service when and I went.
Well,
Merlin was great racing, you know? And then Merlin Breds. You got to love Merlin Breds even to this day. Knicks go. Right? Merlin Bred. Isn't he a Merlin Bred? Knicks go. Yeah.
Well, I'm just pulling out, and I have the... It took everything I had. but
you're the best.
Here it is. I'm going to put it on Twitter. I'm going to send you the chart. The John Campbell, this was the 28th running. And, you know, for those that don't realize, it's a mile and a quarter back then. And it was a grade two at the time.
It's probably the first graded stake, one of the first graded stakes I won.
That's interesting. It was three noses. There were three horses
three
involved.
Noses, and that's what it was. And I think Leather's horse was second, and he thought he won it, if I believe.
Leather's horse was third, 38 paces.
Oh, jeez.
Who was second? Sonny Winters for Ron Alfano.
Oh, jeez.
With Don Leather. Miller aboard.
Yeah. And was Passmore on Leather's horse?
Passmore was on Leatherberry, yes.
You never beat Passmore in photos. I tell you, he's the most frustrating rider there was. You'd go past him at the eight ball, and he'd come back and beat you. So you never wanted to go past him until the wire. You know, if you could go past him at the eight ball, wait. and it's hard to do. You know, you're coming to the eight ball. You know how many times I went past him, and he'd come back and beat me? I mean, he was, I think he was nicknamed the Fox. The Fox, I think, yeah.
Well, this...
But he was a tough rider, and he got beat two noses that day, though. It was two riders, Miller and Black. We were very fortunate to beat Passmore two noses.
This, you came from dead last, Tony.
Yeah. One of the few trips that I came from dead last. You know, I'll never forget Jimbo's father, Vince Bracali Sr., Jimbo Vince Bracali Jr. He used to come watch us both ride at Laurel. And he was a Charlestown trainer and an ex-rider. And I'll never forget walking out of Laurel, because Jimbo and I lived together before he got married. And I was best man at his wedding, and that's a story in itself. We were a day late to the wedding. But anyway, we wound up leaving Laurel one day, and Jimbo's father would come down there and critique us and, you know, watch us ride. And he was a great good trainer, Charlestown homeborn, Charlestown man, homeboy, and an ex-rider. And he'd say, listen, you guys, there's two things I want you to remember. Never get classified as a certain type of rider, speed or come from behind or whatever. Always leave yourself wide open to ride any kind of horse, any style. Never get classified. Well, Jimbo and I was living together. And we said, yeah, that's good. You know, your dad really gives us good advice, Jimbo. Well, I got classified as a speed rider, and Jimbo got classified as take him back and make one run rider. And I'm thinking, boy, his dad must turn over in his grave when he looks up and says, two guys I gave you, I'll never forget the words. Don't ever get classified as a certain type of rider. And here we both got classified. Jimbo, he would drag them back, drag everything back, whether it was turf or dirt. And when we were living together, Jimbo actually taught me how to ride on the turf. And we got into a contest of who could get them the furthest back and come running on the turf and save ground. And all you had to do on the turf was take them back, come running, save ground. And Jimbo and I would leave the gate, right? And we'd be sometimes in the same race. We'd leave the gate. And he'd get back, and I'd be next to him. I'd say, I'm going to get back a little further, Bo. No, you ain't, Blackbird. You ain't getting back further than me. Well, I'm going to save more ground than you, Bo. You ain't saving more ground if I'm on the inside of you. And that's how Jimbo and I rode on turf. And we would, like, be 1-2 and won a ton of turf races at Laurel that meet. He went down there with Tamaro and Dutro. I went down there with nothing. And it was the Hagerstown meet at Laurel, 1973. And I'll tell you why I remember that. And I wound up leading rider, went there with nothing, and wound up leading rider at Laurel Hagerstown meet. And nobody could believe it because I didn't have Dutro, didn't have Tamaro, didn't have nobody. Just had D.C. Bradley, a few people that were just not well-known trainers or just up-and-coming trainers, you know. And I wound up leading rider. And the reason I remember the date is because I still have it. I got a presented me for leading rider a silver wooden-lined cigarette box. Cigarette case. Here you're giving an athlete a cigarette case. And it was engraved. Yeah, it was a cigarette case. And it was a beautiful silver cigarette case lined in some kind of wood that preserves the moisture in the tobacco. And on the top of it, it says, Leading Riders, Hagerstown, 1973. And I never wrote it, Hagerstown. Hagerstown, 1973 at Laurel. Hagerstown at Laurel, 1973. I still got it. It's at my mom's house on her dining room, on her one of her end tables. But that's how I remember that. And boy, Maryland brings back so many fond, great memories. I loved racing in Maryland. It was a great place for a kid to go and learn how to ride, you know, under great riders. You know, at that time, Hardtack was the end of his career. He was riding there. Bill Passmore, Eric Walsh, you name it. There was top riders. Vince and I just lost the bug, and that's where we wound up. He went from Charlestown to Jersey. I went from Liberty Bell to Jersey, left Jersey, and we both wound up at Laurel.
Well, and, you know, Tony, this I'm going to put this chart up. I think people will be, and I'm going to try to find a picture from a newspaper when I get off the air, but now I lost the page. Where is the Campbell? There's the DeWitt Clinton. Boy, there's some, you know, you look, when you look through these American racing manuals, there's stakes that you remember that, you know, have been gone. And, you know, there's ebbs and flows to, you know, to how much money is offered in these stakes. And the fact that the John Campbell was a grade two at the time. But, you know, there's some jocks in here, Tony, that are new names to me from this era. I mean, I was getting out of college in 82. Beside you and Miller and Passmore, I see Eve Turcotte.
Eve Turcotte, Rudy and Ron's youngest brother, younger than Roger, I believe. Or Roger might have been the youngest, but Eve was right in there next to the youngest, or the youngest to Roger. It was Ronnie, Rudy, Roger, and Eve, I think. Or Eve and Roger. I don't know.
And then here's do this by
Benny
based
Feliciano.
On Price.
Benny Feliciano wasn't training. He was a jockey then. Eric Walsh was one of
this chart, the horse by the name of Princelet was fourth. King Leatherberry, by the way, had four horses in this race, but this was a John Campo. This was a Campo trainee, Princelet with E. Nemetti.
Yeah.
Or W. Nemetti.
Billy Nemetti. He got killed in a car crash, I believe. Driving to the Meadowlands from whatever, New York. Billy Nemetti, he was one of those riders that had the bug just after Jimbo and me, or in that period of time. Billy Nemetti. Yeah, you forget all these names from the past. If you name them, I could tell you something about probably every one of them.
How about the fifth horse, the horse that was fifth, it was a good horse, went off as the 3-2 favorite, Pete Moss, for Gil Puentes, but the jock was E. Betia, B-E-I-T-I-A.
Betia.
Yeah,
Betia. Yeah, Gil Puentes, you know, he always had riders that, it's funny, Gil Puentes and Murray Garin, that was his main owner. They leased my contract from Charlie Coco when I had the bug, and I went
Murray Garin owned.
Yeah, Murray Garin. And I went to Merlin with Gil Puentes when New York closed. Went to Merlin with Gil Puentes for 6 weeks because there was no racing in Jersey and New York didn't open until March 1st. So I went that winter meet to Bowie with Gil Puentes. Not that meet that you're looking at, but when I had the bug, 1971. And I almost, he got me in a real jackpot. Gil Puentes, when the lease was up, a couple of days before the lease was up, Charlie Coco brought a couple of horses to Dover Downs. And he says, you know, you're going to be back with me in another few days. I want you to go ride these horses at Dover Downs tonight. So I drove all the way to Dover Downs, and Charlie wasn't there. But I walk in the jock's room. The clerk of scales says, what are you doing here? He says, I ride a horse for Charlie Coco and whatever race. He says, you don't ride a horse for Charlie Coco. I said, yeah, I do. Charlie called me. You know, this was before cell phones and all that, you know. But Gil Puentes told me I wasn't allowed to go, and he had my contract lease. So he called down there and said, when Black comes in the room, tell him to go home. He rides for me at Pimlico or Lord Bowie tomorrow, and he ain't riding tonight and tomorrow. So tell him to go home. Charlie Coco didn't know that, and I didn't ride the horse. They got in touch with Charlie, and Charlie said, called me at the jock's room and whatever it was that next day. He says, when your lease is up with Gil Puentes, you make sure you come up to New York. I got a string of horses up there, and you'll be a gallop boy for the next 6 weeks until Garden State opens. I says, Charlie, I couldn't ride the horse. He says, well, you shouldn't have drove down there, and you shouldn't have gone back to Gil Puentes and ridden for him the next day if you couldn't ride my horse. So I went to, I'm going to be galloping horses for 6 weeks with the bug. So I went to New York, March, whatever it was, first they opened, the last couple of days of February, I went to New York, galloped horses for Charlie. Charlie entered a horse called Was a Roman. And whoever the rider was that was supposed to ride the horse couldn't ride the horse. And Charlie was hung up for a rider. He says, go over and ride the horse. He says, your first and last horse you'll ride for me until we go back to Garden State. Well, yeah, he was pissed, you know, because he said he shouldn't have ridden Gil Puentes' horse the next day if you weren't going to ride my horse that night. And he says, but you can go ride this horse, and then you can just gallop horses. So just go ride them. Don't you know the horse won? When the horse won, Charlie backed off. He says, you know, he says, all right, well, you patched it up. You won a race for me. I think I'll let you ride some horses here. And I wound up winning, like, till I was, like, leading bug rider up there till we left and went to Garden State 6 weeks later. And I think Jamie Arellano was a bug rider at the time, and he was established in New York, and he hated it because I was just like a Jersey, Pennsylvania boy showing up in his territory. But I wound up being leading bug rider and like third or fourth leading rider on the standings, third, fourth, whatever. Had a respectable meet till I went to Garden State. And you know what? You think about these names, and here guys like Jamie are going off. So we talked John Ford, Jamie Arellano, and these guys, they're gone. And I'm fortunate enough, even with my lifestyle of the past, to still be here.
Well, Tony, I got another name from this chart that further down, a horse by the name of Decent Davy, that David Cross sent out with Leroy Moyers.
Moyers, who
does not get enough credit. He won won a lot of races.
He was a New England.
Had a few wins on Star de Nascra. Speaking of great Maryland breds,
yeah. Yeah, the Merlin Breds, they've represented themselves well for many, many, many years. You know, you had a restricted race program for Merlin Breds, and you didn't need it because they won any.